What is dedication?
The thing that drives me every day as a dad is Dariano. We call him Day-Day for short. Every day he's hungry for something, whether it's attention, affection, knowledge. And there's this huge responsibility in making sure that when he's no longer under my wing, that he's a good person. I want him to be able to sit back one day and go, we worked together, we did a good job.
That's dedication. Find out more at fatherhood.gov. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Mark Rose Podcast. Today I'm so excited because one of the best teachers on the planet is here to rock us. And that's Terry Cole, psychotherapist, specialist in the area of codependency. But here's the twist, because you might be like, that ain't me. But if you are someone who crushes it at life, crushes it at work, you know, you got it together. You got your poop in a group. But you're like, damn, relationships, I can't seem to bring my wall down. Damn, I keep trying to take care of everybody. Damn, I just can't seem to figure it out. She'll help us do that. She has a specialty in the area of codependency, but even more specifically, high-functioning codependency. She has a recent book that just came out called Too Much. Go get a copy because you ain't too much. And the book is going to walk you through it. You're going to want to dive deeper. And I promise you that, because when you listen to this episode, make sure you stick to the end, because she got some tips on, one, how do you know it's you or someone you know and love? And how the hell do we move through it? So before we dive into the episode, make sure you hit subscribe on YouTube. Make sure you hit subscribe and the little notification bell so you don't miss any of these, because damn, you'd hate to miss something and change your life, change your relationships, and make it so you don't have to repeat these patterns and choices and get all dizzy. And also, when you hit subscribe, it helps support the show, and that makes me bueno happy. And I don't want you to caretake my needs, because that would make you codependent. But if I could hook in there and just tap into that wound so you can make sure I feel good, that'd be great. Without further ado, here's the amazing Terry Cole. Today, I have returning superstar, psychotherapist, mentor, coach, author. Oh my gosh, incredible author. Godmother of codependency? Can I call you that? Or is that like, yeah.
Please do.
Makes you like an elder, but you're like a young elder. Well, I'm so excited to have Terry Cole back on. Hi.
Hi, friend. Thanks for having me back.
Well, you are the rightful owner of quite a few of the top episodes I've ever done. And that's because we have dove deep into the juicy, and we're going to dive even deeper, juicier subject of high-functioning codependency. You have a new book coming out, which is called Too Much, A Guide to Breaking the Cycle of High-Functioning Codependency.
Yes.
I think for the most people, they go, codependency, me, not me. I'm going to lean to not. And I love how you've actually pointed out that, hands up, we might all be high-functioning codependents. So, let's get into it.
Oh, let's get into it. So let's talk about the why of, for me, why did I write this book? Why high-functioning codependency? What was the urgency? What was the need? Well, let's talk about the definition, according to Terry Cole, of codependency is you being overly invested in the feeling states, the outcomes, the relationships, the circumstances, the finances, the situations of the people in your life to the detriment of your internal peace. Because we're all invested. We're all lovers, right? We're all invested in our people being happy. Obviously, that's called having a relationship. But when you're a codependent, you're overly invested. And how can you tell? Well, you can tell because if your friend calls you with a problem, how quickly does their problem become your problem? Check your urgency. Are you literally dropping everything and being like getting on Google and Googling some shit for your friend so you can help her, or thinking about who you can connect them to or whatever? So it's more than just wanting the people we love to be happy. It's taking it on. And so in my therapy practice, I've been a therapist for 27 years. I would see these behavioral patterns that were codependent, and I would point them out to my clients. And they were all these incredibly high functioning, capable, most of them women. And if I would say, hey, that is a codependent behavioral pattern, they would be like, codependency? Me? Yeah, no. Yeah. Wrong lady. Wrong, because everyone depends on me. I'm not dependent on shit. I'm making all the money. I'm managing all the people. I'm doing all the things. I'm doing all the emotional labor. What are you talking about? And so I realized my clients did not know what codependency was because they didn't identify with the old school Melody Beattie codependent no more. You have to be enabling an alcoholic or an addict to be codependent. And I feel like those myths prevented my clients from seeing themselves in the problem. And I also noticed that there is a different flavor of codependency when you are very capable, right? The irony of this is that the more capable you are, the less codependency looks like codependency, but it's still codependency. So as soon as I added, I coined this phrase and obviously trademarked it immediately, high functioning codependency, my clients all just raised their hands and said, me, I'm the problem, it's me, without shame, because they could see themselves in the definition, and then we could get to work.
Yeah, it's so interesting to think that if you're holding all these worlds up and you're not in a relationship with an addict, like how could I be codependent? Like codependency is about like what would look like overt fawning or people pleasing. Me, I live in Manhattan, I crush, I'm a CEO or whatever it is. Yeah, so when you presented this idea of being able to reflect that they are part of the problem, what did you notice? Or like maybe what are the barriers that people who initially are, and maybe they're listening and they're like, okay, like I'm hearing this could be me. What does it look like? Like what might those behaviors look like? Mm-hmm. And then what do you notice are sort of the initial barriers or ways that people deflect or protect from taking on that truth?
Well, so we'll go through traits, behaviors, and then the blocks. How's that?
Perfect. That sounds perfect.
So traits of high functioning codependency, or HFCs as we call ourselves. And keep in mind, Mark, you know, what we can do about this is so much, which of course is what the book is all about, is that we can get into recovery, right? So this is not something that you're like, I can't wait to be cured. You're not going to be cured. You're going to go into recovery the same way that I did for alcohol and people do for lots of things, where there's a discipline that's required because a lot of this is your nature. My nature is to help and serve all the people all the time. That is literally in my nature. Now, to do it healthily, I needed to get into recovery from sort of being addicted to those over-functioning, over-giving behaviors. So if we look at the traits of HFC, feeling responsible for fixing other people's problems, giving unsolicited advice. Wow, we can't stop with the auto advice giving. We love it so very much. Don't worry, we'll talk more about that later. Being overly self-sacrificing, inadvertently not respecting other people's right to be self-determined and separate, giving till it hurts, going above and beyond, even when you're not asked to. Right? A lot of times we're just like, oh, I saw that your bank balance was low. The overfunctioning parent of the 30-year-old adult child. So I transferred some money so you wouldn't bounce your rent check, you know, always ready to jump into damage control mode. Like I have to say though, as HFCs in recovery or not, dude, we're amazing in a crisis. Like, you want us there. Damage control is like, we're great. Being judgmental of others can be another trait, because really down deep, you kind of believe that you know the right way to do all the things. So we're sort of looking at people who are not doing it the way that we would do it and being like, there's a way more efficient way to do that. Getting frustrated or angry when other people don't take our grade A advice, the advice that half the time they didn't even ask us for, and feeling exhausted, resentful, and bitter, right? Kind of getting martyred and feeling like, oh man, after all I've done, you may not say that, but do you think it? Do you overgive or overfunction and then feel underappreciated? That is a trait of HFC. And in relationships, a lot of times we have blurred boundaries and an imbalance in effort and power, with the HFC often taking responsibility for fulfilling the other person's needs and trying to control most aspects, I would say, of the relationship.
Like through the taking care of everything is really actually using it as an unconscious mechanism of control. So there can't be space, distance, leaving, all that.
Correct.
And for the other person to become a functioning adult?
Yeah, well, here's the thing. I mean, I can tell you that I single-handedly, in my 20s, could take a perfectly capable human being and turn them into an underfunctioner in like 2 weeks.
That's always been one of my favorite things that you talk about.
It's
like
it's
you were
fact,
so
though.
Good at it that you could take a regular functioning adult and make them underfunction.
Yeah, because when you think about the mantras of HFCs are, I got it, is one. And another mantra of HFCs is, it has to be me. I have to do it. I have to do the thing if it's going to be done right, if this thing's going to move forward, if everyone is going to be okay, it has to be me. So that doesn't leave a lot of room in relationship for mutuality, for interdependence, right? And as we know from our Crushing Codependency course, this is really what we're seeking in healthy relationships. We want to move from codependency or even hyperindependence, right? There's a combination. HFCs are such a combo of things. We have codependency where we are relating codependently in our relationships. But what that looks like for us is overgiving and overfunctioning and then not allowing others to give to us. Then there's a hyperindependence where we just go, I got it. I can do it faster. I can do it easier. It's another mantra. Third, it's just easier if I do it myself.
It's like, I can't trust other people. I can't.
Yeah.
It's just, I'll do it well. Yeah. It'd be interesting to see that overlap with leadership that can't delegate. Hey.
Yep. Oh, there's so much. I'm presenting at the Psychotherapy Networker Conference in March. And it's on professional and personal, how this impacts, right? How does codependency like this, HFC-ness, impact leadership? How does it impact how you do and don't delegate? And it does in all areas.
Yeah, especially, you know, you and I have talked about the predisposition that people in like caretaking roles, professions have for this. Like when you look at the professions of coaching or therapy, do you see an overwhelming amount of high functioning?
Oh my God, in my crew, an overwhelming amount of nurses, hospice workers, therapists, so many therapists, but also anything in the medical healing arts and massage therapists. And just there's so much because, and what I hear from them, and again, why I wrote this book, is they're so burnt out. They're so exhausted. They're so just like you can only do it for so long. And then as women are reaching perimenopause and menopause, you're already smashing face first into a stone wall of like, holy shit, what's happening to my life and my body? And the cycle, which might sound weird, and I don't know a better way to say it, but the cycle that I've witnessed of high functioning codependency, and it's a long arc, it's a big, huge arc, is too many fucks for could be decades for all the people and what making sure everyone's okay and anticipatory planning for others and all this stuff, and then bashing into the wall and having zero fucks, like where you can't care, don't care, you're exhausted. I mean, I've literally seen this where it's almost like ceasing to function, and it can be a physical thing when that pendulum goes from so much overfunctioning for so long and smashes all the way the other way. A lot of times it is a physical crisis that will bring it to bear. Exactly. Your body is just like, literally, I can't do it anymore. And we become so resentful. This is the part that matters. Why should anyone want to get into recovery from being a high functioning codependent? Because your relationships matter and how you feel matters and what you think matters and how you're going through your day matters. And it's not all about checking the boxes, right? And giving this up is so scary for so many people because the illusion of control that is created from the behaviors. And let's look a little bit about let's look a little bit into the actual behaviors that people can look and go, am I doing this? Because before you can even see yourself in the behaviors, you have to look at the limiting beliefs that you may have had about codependency and really understand that, like, nothing's wrong with you. We were all raised and praised to be self-abandoning codependents, as I like to say, and that's a fact, right? So the fact that if this is you, welcome to the human race, right? So you can change it, but like, there's literally nothing wrong with you. This is what you were taught to do. And it certainly was what I was taught to do. I don't know if this is true for the younger generations coming up right now, but it's definitely true for women mid-30s to dead, for sure, at least who I've talked to about it. So if we look at the behaviors themselves, look at auto advice giving. So someone comes to you and they're talking about something. They haven't even asked you your opinion, but they're presenting a dilemma, let's say. Do you immediately give advice? Do you have a thought? Do you have a solution? Do you know someone who does that? Do you have a guide? Do you have a book? Do you, right? Just, I see your hand is raised.
Oh, I can think of someone right away where, like, every time I present anything, it's like, yep, the first thing is what I need to do. And yeah, I'm like, and it's always a criticism of it.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
I'm like, can we lead with some celebration instead of always a fucking.
Yeah. I also didn't ask you. And the thing is, we have to understand why we're doing it. The person having a problem is making us uncomfortable. Your discomfort is making me uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. I want to fix your problem. But people don't like to be projects. It doesn't feel good to be a project. And so we have to really, part of the changing this, we have to slow down and realize, even if your heart is in the right place, and people will always say to me, oh, I'm just a helping person. I'm just being nice. What's wrong with being nice? I'm like, dude, if you are compulsively doing this, it is not you being nice. It's an addiction, mm-hmm, right? You being nice is mowing someone's lawn because they're old, right? It's a thoughtful action that you do. Anything that we are doing in an automatic way because it's so habitual and because it's because we're uncomfortable, that's not about the other person. That's about you seeing them as a problem and wanting that problem to be fixed. So auto advice giving, what can we do instead? You can ask expansive questions. You can say, even if they're asking you, because listen, most of us HFCs, we've set ourselves up. Lots of people are coming to us for our grade A advice because we're pretty smart and pretty effective and we like fixing people's problems. Like, this is right, just a reality. But there's such a great cost to the intimacy in your relationships to do so, that it is so worth your while to learn to do something different. It doesn't mean that you will never give someone your opinion. It does mean that won't be the first stop on the train, right? The first stop on the train needs to be, wait a minute, before I say anything, I want to know what you think, because it's your situation and what you think matters way more than what I think. And if they say, I don't know, you can say, all right, but let's just spitball it. If you did know, what would it be, right? And if they go, I really don't know, say, all right, well, I'm here if you want to brainstorm, right? We don't need to, because the illusion is this, Mark. We think we know what other people should be doing in their lives. And the thing is, you don't. Even if their life looks like a fucking dumpster fire, you still don't know what they should be doing, right? And I think I talked about this the last time I was on your show. I don't know if I did, but anyway, I told you the story about my sister having this. I talk about this in the book extensively, which I haven't written about it before, but my sister was in a bad situation romantically, this disastrous domestic situation, living with a guy who was doing crack and she was actively alcoholic and they were living in the woods without running water and no electricity. Okay. So I don't need to embellish that fucking story because it's already just a horror show,
yeah,
of just five alarm fire for this.
Lots of problems to fix in that one.
Yeah. This high functioning codependent was like, oh my God, what can I do? So I was throwing everything at the situation. talking to my sister every couple of days with her telling me another horror story about what this fucking idiot had done. And it was so painful. I was beside myself. So I go into my therapist for the third week in a row, just bawling my face off. And I'm like, Bev, what am I going to do? Like, what am I going to, I've done everything. And she was like, Tara, let me ask you something. What makes you think you know what your sister needs to learn in this lifetime? And I was like, well, I think we can all agree she doesn't need to do it with a fucking crackhead in the woods with no running water. Can we agree with that? And she was like, no, man, because I'm not God. I don't know. But neither do you. But do you know what's going on with you? And I was like, no. So tell me, please. Clearly, I don't have a clue. And she said, you've worked really hard to create a harmonious life. And your sister's shit show is really fucking with your peace. And you just want to fix it so that you will be out of pain. And that was a humbling interaction. She was not wrong. I can promise you she was totally accurate. But my self-image was that I was doing it 100%, you know, Mother Teresa style love, selfless love. That's what it was all about to me. And then to hear that my obsession with fixing my sister's situation had more to do with me than I would have liked to have thought, but it made sense. And I said, okay, so what do I do instead? And she was like, meet a boundary, get a boundary, put a boundary in place. She's like, Tara, you don't need to listen to her talking about this bad situation she's in every day. She feels better. You feel sick. It doesn't work. Set a boundary. So I was able to say to my sister, I love you and I can't talk about this with you because it's so painful. But if you ever want to get out, I will always be your person. And 9 months later, she called and was like, are you still my person? And I was like, fuck yes, I'm putting my shoes on right now. Went and got her from her shack in the woods. And then the most important aspect of that story though, Mark, is that when we are setting ourselves up as the savior for someone else, we are centering their experience on us. And so by having a healthy boundary with my sister, even though it was so painful and I cried my eyes out doing it, it was so hard. But then she got to be the hero of her own story. She went back to school. She got sober. And then I helped her, my husband and I helped her appropriately, but not as she's the fucking loser victim and I'm the fucking family hero as I have been, right? Keeping that position of like, Terry will fix it. But at what cost? And at what cost to Jenna? What cost to my sister having it be that I'm the great one? She gets sober, but if I saved her, quote unquote, then it's really all about me, not about her. And that changed. That really was the seed that started me understanding what codependency really is. And then I got really interested to see how my clients were similar to me, feeling like we needed to help everyone. And it wasn't just the people in our lives. Like HFCs can be a little bit codependent with the world, where we feel a real responsibility for people we don't even know. You know, I actually opened the book with a story about, I was on a platform in Long Island at like 10:30 at night, taking a train back to New York City. I was living in Manhattan and I see this skinny kid standing there holding like a little blanket and a pillow. And I was like, what the, my helper radar pinged. I was like, where the fuck is that kid going this late at night? And so I talked to him on the train and I was like, what are you doing? He's like, oh, I had a job. I was supposed to be driving a car back to Indiana and they just canceled it. So, you know, I go, so what, where are you going? He's like, I'm just going to sleep in the station. And I was like, what station? He's like, well, I don't know anyone in New York. He's like, I'm going to sleep in Penn Station. I was like, no, you're not. You know me. You're going to come to my apartment. I took a total stranger. Don't even know. Could have been a serial killer. Home. We didn't have cell phones. This was like the late 80s, people. So I didn't even call my roommate. I just walked in with a stranger. And she was like, well, of course you couldn't let him sleep in Penn Station. He would get mugged. I was like, correct. Now, I'm not saying that's normal. I am saying, anybody listening or watching this, you have your own, if you're an HFC, you have your own Billy story of someone whose life you felt so responsible for that you were twisting yourself up in a pretzel and lighting yourself on fire and really not even knowing why. There was no space between the thought and the action. This is my problem to fix. Hello? is this my problem to fix? Obviously it was not, but and keep in mind, he was 19 and I was only 22, but still this overly developed sense of responsibility for others, which sometimes we get into, you know, domestic violence work and other things where these qualities can be our superpowers, but only if we get into recovery. Because if we don't, this HFC behavior creates this glass ceiling of our own making when it comes to our success, the intimacy in our relationships, our happiness, because you can't do the amount of bandwidth that we're bleeding by overfunctioning and overgiving and overfeeling and overdoing and auto-accommodating and anticipatory planning and all the self-abandonment and all the overfunctioning. There's only so far you're going to go.
Well, yeah. You know, as you share the story with your sister and the story with Billy, the story with Billy is interesting because when I was young, I played on the soccer team and one of the kids, he was probably like, I don't know, 5 years younger than me. He was probably 19. And I was working at the time. I'd like, you know, gotten a, you know, quote unquote, good job. And I played with a bunch of buddies. He was just like a young new recruit for the team. And his mom was an alcoholic. He had a little brother. His mom was an active addict, blah, blah, blah. And I remember being like, oh yeah, if you need a place to crash, like if you need, you know, all this stuff. Then he asked to borrow money from me. And, you know, a good spirited kid, like no issues, you know, that I knew of. And I was like, hey, I'll lend you, I think you needed $500. With inflation, mm-hmm. that was probably like 50,000 back then. But I said to him, yeah, you know, and I didn't create a boundary around the repayment, but he told me he'd pay me back. What I just noticed is he would just like keep trying to borrow money and keep like one night he called me and my roommate and I, who was on the team, we went and got him from his mom's house. Great. But eventually what I just noticed is he was never actively doing anything to leave his circumstances. Okay. And he was continuing in the same. And I found myself resenting. I found myself, you know, like a Billy story being like, oh, I'm going to save this kid from his, you know, I look back and I can just see how clear that was. But when I finally said no to it, it was like, I was so free from the drama. But the reason I bring this up is because when you talk about the story of your sister, for example, and so many of us, you know, like wanting to take care of our partner who doesn't want to read any books and become good at relationship. Or there's this element where it's like, if I let go, and of course with an addict, it's different, right? It's like, if I let go, they might kill themselves or they might, right? And those are like real things we wrestle with. But I always think like what you said, they become the hero of their own story. So when we're robbing them of that and feeling heroic and egoic and all the things, our self-perception, there's another experience that we have to build our capacity for, which I think is really hard. Like watching someone else skid face first on the ground. And I, you know, I now, as I say that, it's like watching my son fall as he walks because he's 17 months old. Yeah. And it's like the worst, but I'm like, I know that nothing is teaching him faster than the floor and I can't save him from it. Like I want to catch his little forehead. I want to, and he's, you know, we work on falling and now he's much better, but it was such a good metaphor for like life and the like empathic adult parent I am. I'm like, I don't want him to suffer. He got stung by a wasp on his little butt. And I was like, I want to murder that wasp. He'll never get stung again. You know, like all these, you just realize how as you were saying, like it comes from a beautiful place, but it, you pour into all these other cups or you're so focused on how full their cup is being overly invested. Like,
well, what's going to come up is a lot of feelings that you've been numbing and suppressing. And so in the book, I sort of walk you through this whole process. And I also have this beautiful community that people can join where we're going to be walking through this process where we have to slow down. You know, the fact that simply because you can do more doesn't mean that you should. And a lot of times being HFC, I mean, I remember my therapist giving me homework in my 20s and I couldn't do it for so long. She's like, Tara, you have, this is before I started meditating later in my 20s. So this is before that. And it was like you're a socialaholic, basically. I mean, I had already stopped drinking, but I just was such a group girl. I just was with people all the time. I had plans every night. And she was like, you need to like have a night where you're just at home by yourself. maybe writing in your journal, not watching TV, not numbing with music, not really like being with yourself. And I swear to God, I think it took me 3 weeks before I could do it, because it's scary when you're an HFC. So much of your identity is what is being reflected back to you from other people. And you're, the essence of who you are, of course, is still in there. But we have to take time to nurture our relationship with ourselves and to prioritize, right? This is where, of course, boundaries are very important in this process of getting into recovery from HFC. But it's living by the mantra that what I want, what I think, and what I feel matters. And those things matter to me more than what anyone else wants, thinks, or feels. So we learn. Doesn't mean we don't compromise. Doesn't mean we don't meet people in the middle, but we literally have to prioritize ourselves, our thoughts, our feelings, and our desires. In our minds, we need to know that that's okay. And from that place, in long-term relationships, of course, we compromise, right? If, you know, doesn't mean we're not going to do shit we don't want to do, because hello, welcome to being a human on planet Earth, right? We're always, if you're going to be in relationship with people, you're going to be doing some stuff you don't want to do, but you're not living your life as this sort of covert people pleaser. Because the thing with HFCs is that we have a very polished exterior. So no one's checking. Trust me. Nobody's checking in on Terry. Like, everyone is like, obviously, duh, she's fine. Because she's always fine. And I feel that with the HFCs in my crew, they really identify with this sense that they're the pillar. Like, we're so strong. We know what we can do, but it's the softness that's hard. It's the surrender that is the challenge. It's the allowing, right? For me, there was such a journey of allowing Vic, my husband, to be the soft place for me to land in my life that he's become. It took so long for me to trust that the other shoe wasn't going to drop with him and that I didn't have to manage. And of course, it was also the perfect storm because he was widowed and divorced and had three acting out teenage sons. So I was like, fucking perfect. I love it. So many things to fix.
A lot of work here.
Just keep working. But interestingly, he was the first person in my life that I ever trusted enough to be truly vulnerable with, where, and trusted, because he's so effing capable. It would require me to find somebody 100 times more capable than me for me to trust that they could do it. And he is that and more, thank God. But what's on the other side of, if you're not doing that in your life, right? If you're a high functioning codependent and you're managing the people in your life, which is what I was certainly doing before Vic, all the relationships I had, it was, people were projects for sure. I was like, can't wait to make you better than you are. It's going to be amazing. But I was not relating to people in a heart-centered way, and certainly wasn't allowing them. I was terrible at receiving. And what ends up happening, of course, is sooner or later, people stop offering. If you never take them up on it, they're like, I guess she doesn't want it. I guess she's okay. And it was really my mother who was like, I was saying, I don't get Vic. Like, he's great, but he like always wants to like drive into New York to pick me up to just drive me back to New Jersey with him. And it just doesn't make sense. And I was like, Mom, I could just take the train. It's 20 minutes. And she was like, Tara, he wants to come scoop you up. Cause that's what he would say. Let me just come scoop you up. And I would be like, that makes no sense logically. My mother was like, hi, stop saying no. This guy wants to scoop you up and you think you love him. Let him scoop you up. Like, stop controlling everything. And suddenly when you start allowing this in your life, like, life is so much more satisfying and you are known on such a deeper level, but it takes time sort of to get to that place.
Yeah. And it feels so vulnerable. You know, it's like we spend our lives creating the veneer, the mask that we got our poop in a group. And, you know, like, God forbid we let someone see that we don't have it figured out or we don't. When you look at the origins of high functioning codependency, How do you see that differing, or is it just a different manifestation or expression of how regular codependency is found?
I think that it's interesting. I think that there's a lot of similarities, mm-hmm. right? But if you're a high-functioning codependency, the way that you reacted to the chaos was by excelling. So, and not all kids do.
Yeah, that's right.
But
true.
You become like, I'll be the best student. I'll be the best gymnast. I'll be the star athlete. I'll do more. You are the helper. A lot of times we are the hero children in disordered family systems where we are helping. It's not necessarily the golden child, right? That's different where, you know, they can do no wrong, but the hero child is the one who is doing the heavy lifting, helping everyone in the family, certainly making the family look good. And so I think that if we look at relational blueprints, because your HFC blueprint, which I walk you through in the book, it's, you know, every part of the things that we learn in life, we have blueprints, right? What are they? That's just the unconscious paradigm in your mind. A lot of times it's stuff you're really not even aware of that is down there in the basement that says, hey, this is the way to relate. This is how you do it. So we learn from modeled behavior in the family of origin, and we learn by our reaction to our environment. So if you had someone who, you know, in healthy family systems, it's child focused, not child obsessed, but child focused, where what Jasper needs is at the top of the list of what you guys are going to do. His developmental phase, if he's going to be going to daycare, someone will be available to drive him and pick him up. Those things will be vetted. Again, not child obsessed, helicoptering per se, but in disordered family systems or dysfunctional systems, a lot of times there is a different identified center or identified patient, whether that's the alcoholic, whether that's the abuser, whether that's someone with a mental health challenge, where the entire family system is now organizing around that person. So children learn very quickly in that situation that it's very important that you better be helpful. You better not cause any problems. You better not be like, you don't have any needs. Just right. Your needs don't matter. What matters is, so what we learn in those family systems is to be other focused. So we grow up to believe that being loving is being other focused. And it's too much, not other focused in a healthy way where there's mutuality, right. Other focused where it's all of the focus is we're putting it on other people and how we can be of service to them or how we can help them or to protect ourselves. You know, if you think about being an HFC, we have a stadium full of data in our minds about other people. We know all your likes and dislikes. I know your entire romantic history. I will not forget a thing that you ever tell me about you. But when you're an active HFC, either you don't know those things about yourself because you've never taken the time to find out, and you certainly don't expect the reciprocity. Like, I mean, I'm fine. Listen, whatever you guys have is fine. Like, Ali, it's fine. Like, you know what I mean? As opposed to, we just don't want to be a burden to other people a lot of times.
I've noticed with me, one thing that I have a conversation with Kylie about a lot is, you know, as you said, we like get to this place where it's not optional, right? And you were talking about, you go from like so many fucks to zero fucks to, and of course it's the right kind of fucks that we want to get to. And I've noticed that like one conversation I always have with Kai is to say, like, my challenge is to advocate for myself. Like, my challenge is to actually say, this is what I want. This is what I need. Although I'm getting much better at it. But I say to her, like, I actually need your help in doing that. Like, I need your support in doing that. I need you to actually encourage that, because like her self-advocacy is not the problem, you know, and not that she does that on intentional. She just has a healthy sense of self. So for me, that's like, and it's not exploitive or anything like that. It's that I'm so used to accommodating that accommodation is just like, oh yeah, like Mark's got it. But that's because I would try to not take up too much space.
Yes.
So when we start to step into this more healthy sense of relating, does it require the other person to be aware of our changes? And what will people act like if they're not? Can we do it without them knowing? And what might we expect?
Yes. Well, you can't really do it without them knowing, because relationships are a dance.
Yeah.
So if you've been doing the foxtrot for 20 years and you start doing the bump, someone's going to notice. I just dated myself with both of those things so hardcore.
Yeah, I was like, wow, that's, they didn't even teach those in my gym class in junior high.
but you know what I'm saying? Like we do the same thing, right? Our relationships are dances. When we change our steps, people will notice. Now, how I walk you through it in the book and how I teach it is that it's okay if people notice. The most people's desire is they're like, I can't wait to get the fucking bullhorn and tell everyone everything's going to be different now. Yeah. I'm not doing everything for everybody. You could do your own fucking laundry or whatever it is. But we're not going to do that because the first thing in the first half of the book, we go in because this whole thing is an inside job. Then we come out. So yes, because it is a relational pattern issue, obviously, so much of what we change is how we're relating to other people, ourselves, and the world. But we need to have a deeper understanding of why and have compassion for ourselves. Like any person who suffers from being an HFC, you have 1,000,005 good reasons to be that way. So like nothing's wrong with you. This, it's adaptive. It worked for you, right? It worked. The stuff that was adaptive in childhood becomes maladaptive a lot of times in adulthood. But like, thank God, like our little unconscious brain somehow figured out how we were going to survive childhood with the least amount of damage as possible. Thank you. So when we start changing in our relationships, it depends on how good your communication is in the relationship as to whether you should talk about it or not. You can, and you don't need to. I mean, I like the idea if you're in a good relationship and there's a friendship there too, of saying, wow, I'm reading this book and I'm really learning a lot about myself. And I'm trying to be more independent in certain ways, like it, or I'm trying to be less auto advice giving. So I don't want you to think I don't care. Like there's ways that we can sort of warn people, but I actually think next right action after next right action. And it's the small steps that you take consistently that will bring you to a place of your new normal where there's more equitability. Some conversations you will have to have, especially if you're doing all the emotional labor and a lot of the actual labor to keep your family life going. Like it won't work if your partner has 6 things on their list and you have 440 that you all do every week and you both work, right? And even if you don't both work, whoever stays home, they're working too, whoever it is. Because now, you know, sometimes it's the husband. If it's a heterosexual situation, it's not always the wife. I mean, I would say it's still more the wife than the husband. So you may have conversations and you may get pushback. But I think that being prepared when you go, all right, I know that they're going to notice and maybe they're going to be upset, but I'm also not doing anything wrong. And I can stay lovingly attached to my people while I make these changes, because you can. People are, your relationships are more resilient than you know. You are more resilient than you know. And I think that just having faith that if you do it little by little, your new normal will literally start to emerge. And you might be shocked at how flexible your partner is. You've just never told them. You've just never asked them. You've just never given them the opportunity to step up for you in a way that you need. And it's so humbling to do so. And yet it's so satisfying and feels so good when we let people love us, when we let people give to us. You know, the last part of the book, the last chapter is about surrender, right? Just surrendering to the reality. If I had done that sooner with my sister's situation, I would have known that it wasn't my situation. I mean, my therapist said, Terry, I'm not telling you that you shouldn't save Jenna. I'm telling you that you can't, like that it is an impossible task and that it's not your task. But that really shifted something for me in getting away from this thought of it has to be me and really realizing the power of respecting people's sovereignty and their right to succeed and to fail, to be amazing and to flail in their own life. It's not for you to protect them from that when you really get it that you're protecting yourself from it. And so we really start relating differently and having a different, even just if the only thing you took away from this podcast was that instead of auto advice giving, you were going to start to ask expansive questions, that will change your relationships. Literally, yeah. That one thing will change your relationships.
Yeah, it would change the engagements in which you have with other people who are used to you just fucking offering right away, or they distance from you because that's what you do.
Yeah.
You know? And I think of the richness of actually getting to be witnessed, you know, that like we spend our lives not wanting to be seen for protective measures. And as you said, what a beautiful adaptive strategy that as an adult is not actually contributing to the types of relationships you want to create. It is from a safety perspective, but even that is an illusion, you know, like you're not actually, you don't feel safe because you have to be a chameleon.
Exactly. It doesn't even create safety. But if you look at what you could say instead, like what is expansive questioning or empathic listening look like instead of problem solving or auto advice giving? How do you feel about that? Could you tell me more about that? Is there more you want to say about that? I'm sorry you're going through that. That's a crappy situation. That sucks. Do you want to talk about it? Like, but we're literally focusing it back on the invitation for them to share more, because visually, the way that I think about it, like metaphorically in my mind, is what I want for my friends is a willingness for them to be in the foxhole with me, with being brave enough to let me feel my pain in their presence, to not try to auto fix me like I'm some project for them, because that doesn't feel good. I don't like that at all. And when someone can do it, and it's funny, I know exactly who is capable of doing it in my life. And when the shit hits the fan, they're the only people I want to talk to, because I don't need a strategy. And if I do, I'll ask you. Like I have a lot of great minds in my life. If I need a strategy, I'll ask. What I need is someone who can compassionately and lovingly witness where I am. With the faith, even just saying, I'm not sure what to say right now, but I am here to listen.
Man, everybody, come on now. There's an opportunity to move through this. You said something years ago that I'm guessing is most likely in your book, but that we rob people of the opportunity to truly know us.
Yes.
And that's like, I think about that a lot of like our own over-functioning, one doesn't allow someone else to become an adult themselves. So we like rob them of themselves being able to see that they're capable. But when we're chameleons, no one gets to see us. And that, like, what a beautiful gift it is. And I think we don't, and I love the way you teach all of this, because what you're really like, how you say that, like, we are colluding in this. This is not a, they don't let us be us. We're part of, we're not a victim of that. We are actually not being ourselves.
Yes. And how painful, like that's such a high cost. And in witnessing people, you know, older women in particular coming into my practice, just sort of being like, hey man, I played by the rules. I did all the things. I checked all the boxes. And they're like, is this the way I'm supposed to feel? Is this all there is? And the devastation of that is because you took one for the team so many times. You said yes when you wanted to say no. You did all the quote unquote right things according to society. But the people in your life do not actually fucking know you. And so the existential loneliness that you feel is real. And the tragedy is that how can anybody authentically love us if we never allow them to authentically know us?
I mean, on the journey of authentic self-expression, you know, and figuring out the things that create that, what it looks like, and then how to work through it. So everyone, go buy this book right now. One, because it's an incredible book and Terry's an incredible teacher, and this is going to walk you out of high-functioning codependency so you can liberate yourself, get your authentic self out there, create authentic relationships, if that's not juicy. And also, do it because supporting a new author is incredible. So go pre-order, go order, go do all the things. And also, Terry, what else do they get? Because I know you're like a bonus machine and also you have a really incredible relationship summit that I have the honor of being in. So tell us all the details.
So we're going to go to terrycole.com/HFC for high function codependency, where you're going to find that we are doing a relationship summit with 30 of the world's top relationship experts, including Mark. So exciting, doctor. We've got so many people. Jillian Turecki, I just interviewed. We have Dr. Daniel Amen. We've got Dr. Shefali. We've got just a zillion different people. And it's also, so it's not even just romantic relationships, right? We're talking about familial relationships as well, because, you know, a lot of times we have problems in those. So the greatest minds all coming together, and it's totally free. You need to sign up for it though. So please do. And at the terrycole.com/HFC, you'll also see a place where you can buy the book. And then I have all kinds of amazing bonuses that are coming along with the book. One is that you'll be right into our groovy book club, which I've never done before. And it's so super fun. So we will be talking about the book. I'll be taking your, you know, so pre-order the book. And you can also go to hfcbook.com. Like, you'll see, we'll put them all in there. So the free online book club, we're doing an HFC workshop. So I'm walking you through so that you can see, like, where are you in this process? There's meditations, there's communication scripts, there is an HFC toolkit, like a toolbox. So if you're kind of in the beginning of this process and you're like, I don't fucking know, I'm going to give you an assessment that's going to help you know where you are and what are your next best steps. So many amazing things, so exciting. I'm just so pumped. And the summit is really, I've learned so, it's so crazy. I've been doing this for 27 years. Mark, I learned so much by interviewing all these people for the summit. I was like, oh my God. So terrycole.com/HFC.
Perfect. Link will be in the bio. Terry, thanks so much for your time, your brilliance. Thanks for writing this book.
Thank you. I love you. I appreciate you.
Love you too. Right back.